Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me today for another fantastic in-depth interview that will really enlighten and empower you and your relationships. Before we jump into things, I just want to welcome anyone who may be listening for the first time, and I invite you to go to my website, which is drcherylselman.com, or like me over on my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, because when you go there, either opt in or like me on Facebook, I'll be posting the interviews that I do. I'll be sending them out to you along with other great educational materials. So it's another great and wonderful way to be sure to listen to all of these amazing interviews and to continue to expand your own knowledge and empowerment. So I hope you'll be joining me there. Either on Dr. Cheryl Selman or What Women Must Know. And I also want to say that I have one new show on Progressive Radio Network every Saturday at 11 a.m. called The Love Code. I hope you'll join me there because this is a very special program that I wanted to do dedicated to bringing the most enlightened spiritual teachers, authors, thought leaders, who will uplift, transform, heal your life. So it's a very spiritual orientation, and it's great for your heart and for your soul. So I hope you'll be joining me every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. And let's jump into my topic and my wonderful guest today. So we're going to be exploring how to get the love you want with Dr. Harville Hendricks and Dr. Helen McKelly Hunt. And they are the authors of the New York Times bestselling book, Getting the Love You Want, that has sold more than 4 million copies around the world. And I just want to say before I bring them on that this has been a transformational book for me personally. When I was introduced to this work many, many years ago when I was a psychotherapist, it provided me with the understanding, the knowledge, and the strategies to help not only my relationship, but my patients' relationships in my psychotherapy practice. And I went on and taught a lot of workshops that incorporated this information. So I'm just letting you know what an honor it is to have Dr. Harville Hendricks and Dr. Helen with us, Helen McKelly Hunt with us, because their book has changed the lives of millions and millions of people to understand and get through the juggernaut of relationships. So having said all that, I want to welcome Harville and Helen to the show today. Hello and welcome.
Hello, and thank you for having us on.
We are delighted to be here.
You know, I really cannot extol your virtues enough because your work is so profound and has changed the nature of relationships for not just couples, it's families, it's in work, it's for children. It is so deep and has such ramifications for creating a peaceful world. And I just honor both of you for your dedication, your hard work you've done over the many, many decades to get this information out. There is no more confusing area in our life than relationships. I have to say, you probably agree, because we don't have a roadmap and we don't know what we're doing there. And when we fall in love, we think we found it. In fact, it's just the beginning of a very interesting healing journey. And that's what we're going to talk about today, unraveling the myths and misinformation of relationships and how to get us back on track. So big topic, but a really important one. So maybe I should just throw out the most important question to begin with is, why do we choose the person we choose? What is going on in the nature of relationships?
Well, I actually have a comment. Can y'all hear me?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I'd really love Harville to answer that question, but I'd like to make a comment first. Would it be okay?
Oh, absolutely.
I just want to take a sentence that you said, and I don't remember anyone saying it just like the way you said it, because it was quite arresting. for me, and you said, if I got it, that there is no more confusing issue in our lives than our relationship, which you then tried to laugh because it's so horrible. So is that what you said? Is that right?
Sounds like it could have been.
Right. Okay. All right. So, and I just want to say, it is absolutely unbelievable that I'm married to someone for whom that is absolutely not true. And I guess a small prolegomena to this show, this podcast, is that I don't know why, but Harville, one of his many talents is to take what mystifies others and he simplifies it. The way I phrase it is, it's simple but profound. It has all the depth, but it's simple, simple, simple. So with that, I'll turn it over to Harville to answer the first question.
Okay.
And I just want to say, Helen, you're very blessed in this lifetime to have found such a wonderful partner. You must have had good karma in past lives or something, because it's really wonderful for you to hear that. And it is true for some couples, but it's more unique than common, I would find.
Yeah. Well, and I'm blessed to find somebody who thinks that about me. So,
right.
Yeah, you've got a good comment too, Harville.
Right.
Yeah. I think we got a mutual admiration party going on here. So now I have the burden of being simple and clear. And I think that I can do that in a few brief sentences, because it is the universal question about how in the world do you wind up with the person you're with. It starts off with such joy and excitement and usually winds up as a nightmare. And, you know, what happened to that person you fell in love with when a few weeks or months or years later they don't appear to be the person that you remember meeting? So we work with that, started working with that in the middle 1970s, with the question about why do couples fight. And we did research on that for about 8 years, which led to the book, Getting the Love You Want, being written and published in 1988. So here's what we basically discovered and answer in short. The short version of this is that we wind up with a person in adulthood similar to a person who is similar, we wind up with somebody in adulthood who is similar to the caretakers with whom we lived in childhood. And the reason we do that is that those caretakers were not perfect, and no caretaker on the planet has ever been, so it's universal. And their lack of perfection meant that there were certain specific needs essential to our survival as infants and children that they did not meet. And the infant's mind is bonded, attached to this caretaker, so that in memory, in the infant, that this caretaker becomes a figment in the infant's memory system, which stays there until adulthood. And in adulthood, in the search and find mission for that intimate partner for life, this caretaker who has negative traits, i.e. Didn't meet the child's needs, becomes the template out of awareness, unconscious, would not do it deliberately, but the template into which we use to identify and select our adult life partner. That person will be similar to the caretaker. When we meet them, we will fall in love, not knowing that we're falling in love with somebody similar to the caretakers, who have traits similar to the caretakers with whom we were frustrated in childhood. And we attach then to this person the expectation that they will, in fact, meet the needs in adulthood with you that were not met in childhood with the caretaker. obviously this person, similar to the caretaker, will not meet those needs because they cannot meet those needs at the time they meet. They can grow into it, but not at the time they meet. So frustration will set in. You will expect them unconsciously to start doing stuff that you needed since childhood. They won't do it because they don't know how and they don't know you need it. So consequently, and that's mutual. Both people are doing the same thing. So that leads to what we call the power struggle, the end of romantic love, rise of the power struggle, and the impasse, which couples can stay in most of their lives, unless they go read a book, go to therapy somewhere, and find this out, because this information is not available in the general culture. And so, therefore, you don't get it until you show up at a radio show like this or read a book or go to therapy. But that's our view of it.
So, it's, you know, your work is so profound because it understands that, first of all, the person that we have this immense attraction to and for is activating an unconscious memory of the people or person we bonded to when we were young in life but couldn't have our needs met in the way we needed to have them met. So it's like this unfulfilled wound that is held in place.
Yes.
And when we find someone who unconsciously, it's like, you know, it's that story, you can scan the room of 500 people, and if you had an alcoholic father, the only person you'd be attracted to in the whole room of 500 people is that one alcoholic. How do you do
right.
that? That's pretty amazing, right?
Yep.
That you're
right.
That you can do that. So
it is.
There's a purpose for why we attract who we attract, and that's what makes your work unique in understanding that and healing that. You know, just going to couples therapy and talking about what your partner did and strategies to kind of move things, you know, like objects around on a table, will not heal a relationship. You have to go deeper, and that is why your work is so profound, because it gives that roadmap. So can we elaborate a bit on the imago, your imago therapy, what is really going on in the different stages of our development and how we reenact that in relationships, which I want to say not only happens in intimate relationships. You can create your imago match in your work environment. You can do it in all sorts of ways that will show up.
Yes, right. Yes, you can, which is a generalizable feature of that we actually didn't know back when we were putting this system together. We began then to discover it as we had people say, oh, well, I had this attraction to my boss or to my job or to my church, and I went through this romantic period, and then things began to not feel good, and so that felt like the power struggle, and then I had the same problem. So, yes, it seems to be the way the mind works. And if we know that, then when you get into the impasse, into the conflict, you know that you're participating with the human race in doing the same thing. So there's nothing special about it or wrong with you. In fact, Helen quotes this thing in a phrase that we use a lot called conflict is growth trying to happen. So that the conflict provides the opportunity to grow in ways that you would not grow without the conflict.
Okay, so there are actually three stages in your model, three stages of a relationship. Can you elaborate on that, Hazel?
Sure.
Or Helen?
Helen, you want to do that?
Well, it's a beautiful concept that every passionate relationship begins with the romance stage of the relationship. You meet someone and suddenly you feel unlike you've ever felt with anyone else in your life. It's just this whole neurochemical whatever that you suddenly feel dizzy and excited. And we call that falling in love. And the falling in love, stage one, is always followed with stage two, which is the power struggle. And inevitably, people get disappointed. They wake up one day and go, gosh, this isn't as easy as I thought it would be. I think this partner that I thought I was in love with, I think they're actually a jerk. And so you sort of don't know what to do. And many people break up at that time. But inevitably, what people don't know is there's a stage three, which is real love. That the period of romance is not real love. It's a bait to pair you with a certain kind of person that, if you learn to handle it right, can result in a mutual healing of one another's past. But you don't know all that. And so in the power struggle, if you can get the right information, any couple can be transformed out of the power struggle and into the third stage of real love.
And that's really the gift of relationships, is to work through these wounds, these childhood wounds that have been embedded in our, you know, in our neural net, so to speak, so we can heal, so we can truly open to love and heal our hearts and heal the places that have been wounded, so we can move into true unconditional love. And that's, you know, and have a partner that can really move with us at this stage of life and fulfill a greater purpose and passion together.
Yeah.
So it's like that's what we all want, but it takes takes work to get there, because this is, it's not just a psychological process. I see it as a deep spiritual process that is going on. I know that's part of you know, what you're helping people do. So can we expand upon that a little bit?
I think the word spiritual is appropriate, especially in the way that I use, and I think Helen uses spiritual, that spiritual is a term that refers to a kind of sense of belonging to the universe, a kind of desire that we all have to experience ourselves as being a part of the whole. And it may have idiosyncratic forms in terms of a particular religious tradition, but underneath that tradition, there's this universal oneness and universal connecting. And we think that is both psychological and spiritual. There's no real boundary between the two, that it is our human experience to desire to belong to the whole and to be a part of it, and that when we rupture that, when we lose that awareness, we think, Helen and I think, that in losing that awareness, the awareness of connecting, it produces most of the human problems, because you get anxious when you don't feel like you belong. You feel like you're alone and lonely. And, you know, we have a loneliness epidemic now. Somebody said some research about 40% of Americans are anywhere into the loneliness, and depressed syndrome right now. And we would say that has to do with the quality of their relational experience. So we think the relationship itself is a resource for connecting at a personal level, which when you connect at the personal level, you connect to the whole, to the cosmic level, and that those two things are indistinguishable. You lose it locally, you lose it cosmically. If you get it locally, you get it cosmically, and that it all happens at the local, but can go either way. So yes, we think it's really a spiritual process, and that is much bigger than just my psychological background or my personal history. That all of that happens in a context that is the whole of being, the whole of the universe.
Which makes this work so, so, so profound and has a greater purpose than what we might initially imagine.
Yeah, I've actually toyed with the fact that the word whole, you know, we have a childhood wound, and I think of that sometimes as a hole in my heart. But that whole, H-O-L-E, if handled it in the right way, can make me a more whole person, W-H-O-L-E, if I find a partner and the two of us commit to heal each other's childhood wounds. And in the process of two people making that commitment and pledging to try to heal each other's childhood wounds, that is, to me, a holy experience. And somehow that word, H-O-L-Y, shows up in the middle of people seeking to be W-H-O-L-E because they have H-O-L-E-S. So it's sort of a...
I love that.
The holiness. The holiness. Yeah, the holiness is there for those who have eyes to see it.
Yeah. Yeah, the transformation is there if you choose to understand what's going on and then do the work to do the healing. So can we, to help people understand, can we talk about the different stages of wounding, and then we can talk into some of the strategies that you incorporate in your work to help heal, so people can get a sense of what the story is here.
Yeah. So when we take a developmental view of us as human beings, we posit, along with our colleagues in this field of developmental psychology, that there are six basic stages from childhood to adulthood. And the first one is the stage of connecting, with which we begin life. If that works well, then there's a stage of exploration in which we begin to look outside and away from the caretaker to we're curious about the world, the flowers, the bees, the dogs, and whatever else. And this happens about the second 2 years. And then you move into the stage of becoming a self, discovering your identity. That's two more years. Then becoming competent. That's about two more years. And then you start moving outside the family when you go to school, and that's what we call the stage of caring or chumship. You find a best friend, and that's up to about age 12, and then you move into adolescence where you have your first love affairs. So if you have attuned caretaking, which very few people have, you can go through these stages and reach adulthood intact, feeling connected. You will not have bad memories that will be a part of the attraction to what we call your imago match. Your imago match will be also minimally a challenge when they were children. And so you won't ever show up for therapy or want to read books on relationships, because you will just have evolved into adulthood with some relational maturity. But most of us have a wound at the biggest and worst wounds are what we would call the connecting stage. Where we are, our job is to attach to our caretakers and to experience that attachment. If that's ruptured by the caretakers, and we think caretakers rupture it in two ways, they're either sort of overly protective and invasive, or they are neglectful. Then you have what we would call a connectional rupture, and that will trigger our anxiety. If when you begin to explore as a two-year-old, the world around you and the caretakers don't support that or become make you feel cautious, then you'll have what we call a wound at the exploration stage, and you'll be sort of afraid to be curious and afraid to be exploratory. At the identity stage, if you don't get supported when you're trying to figure out who you are, you'll come up with a confused self-image. And at the competence stage, if you don't get supported, you won't have a sense of what your abilities are. And if you don't get supported when you start to make peer friends from 6 to 12, then you'll either be overly aggressive, overly dependent, or you'll be an avoider. And the same thing will happen with the in adult love affairs from 12 to 20. So all of these injuries are developmentally specific, but they're all about the same thing. which is the quality of the interaction that the child has with the caretakers as the child is growing through these developmental stages. So whatever stage you're wounded in childhood will fix the picture of the caretaker for you, and then in adulthood, when you look for a love partner, you will pick somebody who is similar to you developmentally. For instance, let's say your injury came at the identity stage at about the age of 4. So your identity is you can be either rigid about that, I am George and this is me, or you can be confused about that. You say, I don't quite know who I am. You'll pick somebody having that same issue, but it'll be a little opposite. That is, if you're rigid, you'll be attracted to somebody who's confused about who they are. And that will be true. It's an interesting that is true all through the developmental stages. Like if you were injured at the exploratory stage and you're not curious anymore, you don't look around, you'll be attracted to somebody who's very overly looking around, overly rebelliously so. And so the two of you make up for what would be true of each one of you if you were not wounded. And it's really fascinating that our minds, no matter what the developmental injury is, leads us to find somebody with whom we can finish that developmental stage. If we understand that that's what the unconscious is trying to do, and if we get some guidance in doing it so that we don't repeat the stage, but actually do what the brain is trying to do, the unconscious is trying to do, redo the stage correctly. So this is the healing power of relationship, that the relationship can help you finish childhood no matter what stage the injury occurred. We just think that is amazing that nature is set up that way, but it appears to be.
Well, it's so profound, and there is an irony because you attract someone, and it goes on the other way as well, that your partner attracts you because of this unconscious recognition that this is the perfect match of someone who will bring these unmet needs to the surface for healing.
Right.
But the problem is we don't know what the game is, and then we get stuck in what you define as that power struggle stage, trying to get the other person to give us the needs that we want but never got and therefore can't get because it's not in our programming until we heal.
That's right. Yes. So that when you said earlier about the relationship being confusing, that's really confusing to if you're caught in that, and was to me, and I'm sure to Helen, back in the old days when we didn't know what was going on. But what we've looked at it now for about 40 years plus, and find that the pattern is consistent for gender and across cultures, that human beings are universally the same. They go through these developmental stages, and that whether it's an arranged marriage like in Asian countries or a marriage by choice in America, the same dynamics in the relationship happen, and the same interventions work. It's just there will be cultural overlays and cultural guidelines about when and how to do it and what to do.
So we'll talk about some of the strategies that help to heal this, but I think it's just important to say that because these unfinished issues will surface in a relationship at some point in time, and I think I remember from the work I've done at the in-love stage, if you're lucky, it'll last, 3 or 4 years, if you're lucky, but generally ends a lot sooner than that, and then you get into the nitty-gritty of the...
Yeah. Yeah, I think the people who studied that have given an average of about 18 months, which means it could be over in a week, or it could be over, and the other end of that is about 4 or 5 years. But before the seventh year will be gone, and that's the place from 5 to 7 years is the highest point of divorce, and which means that the bonding attraction is finally eroded for, and does for everybody, some within the, as I said, the first few weeks, some on the honeymoon, some get through a few months. The average gets through 18 months. And what we want to say to people about that is that that's, we want to normalize this. This is the way nature works. So when you're into this dynamic of trying to get needs met and your partner's pulling on you and you're pulling on them, to know that this is normal and to know that you can end the drama of that and actually get your needs met, but not by the way most people try to do it.
Which just brings up the next point, that if you don't do the healing and you leave a relationship because it's too intense, it's too painful, there's too much drama going on, then you say, well, great, you know, I picked the wrong person and I'm going to find the right person in the next relationship. And then the next relationship comes along, and after that honeymoon stage ends, there you are with the same patterns, meeting yourself again in the same way. So it doesn't really work to keep changing partners if you don't do the inner work to attract something, to do the healing so you can attract someone who can really meet your needs in a more functional way.
Yeah, because when you change partners, you'll pick somebody who's so similar, or in some cases who's the opposite, but that will produce a different set of problems. And it's like, is everybody messed up? But then the answer is, yes, we all are, including you. That this is a universal dynamic. And that, you begin to think, well, everybody I meet is cold and withdrawn. That means that's how men are or that's how women are. And we begin then to categorize people. So it's really important to know that you are the one making the repeat cycle, and your brain is calibrated to pick a particular kind of person. So if they show up twice, they will show up three times, and sometimes then people give up. They say, well, there's nobody in the world except people like that. And that's really the tragedy, because if you're not engaged in an interacting relationship, you cannot grow beyond your particular the level of development, because we are social creatures. We're created by engagement with our caretakers. And if there's no engaging other, we then get stuck, because you can't grow by yourself. You can only grow in the tension of difference and the tension of opposites.
So what you're saying is that a relationship is the most powerful personal growth process you could ever want to create for yourself.
Yes, and the most challenging and difficult and painful, but it's sort of the way nature set it up. As Ellen and I sometimes sit around and say, how come it was set up like this? Why couldn't it be that if you blew it, the next time around, you know, the universe would give you the person who would meet your needs, not somebody who won't.
Well, to sort of shift the energy a little bit here, I mean, to me, it is so exciting that having a healthy relationship results in brain health. And if you have a healthy brain, no matter who you're with, you have beautiful neurochemicals coursing through your body of dopamine, acetylcholine, or epinephrine, and it feels good. But the neuroscientists say you have to practice to have brain health. And I always love doing the brain lectures in our work and any of the writing about the brain, because to me it's so fascinating that our partner's needs help you, to address them well, help you create a very healthy brain for you to live with much more joy and wonder in your life.
And that's such an important point to make, Helen, that you are actually healing yourself on all levels, including your brain, so you can perceive in different ways, so you actually have a way of interacting with your partner that is more loving and caring.
So yeah, for example, go ahead. Could I make one more point
Oh, please. Yes,
For example, once Harv and I agreed to marry each other, I just vowed I was going to pay attention to him and figure out how to meet his every need and really try to help him succeed in life. If there was anything that needed improving, I was going to dedicate myself to help him be the best he could be. And so I thought this was a great gift to Harville, and that I was great, God's great gift to Harville, because I was so dedicated and I'm good with technical assistance, and I wasn't even going to charge him. It was just absolutely free that I could help him with his wardrobe. He didn't have a very good wardrobe when we met. It was sort of this bon vivant, like flashy, like in the 1970s and 80s. It was like paisley silk shirts, and he needed to look like a scholar. And then he sometimes would have tell jokes at dinner with some important people, and nobody was laughing. Like, he didn't realize he's not that funny all the time. And his parenting needed some things. And, you know, if I don't tell him, who's going to? And for some reason, we just had a horrible marriage. He didn't seem to want to go out with me and play or have fun. And it was like, it took a decade or two for me to realize that Harville didn't want me to know him. He wanted me to not know him. And he wanted me to ask him questions about him. And I always thought, I know so Harville so well, if you want to know how he feels, just ask me, because I already know how he feels. Like, I really pay attention to him. And that was just decimating him. I was just eradicating him because he couldn't be him. He was who I thought he was in our relationship. So he was just miserable. And then I was miserable, but he was miserable. But once I started practicing not knowing him and just asking him questions and wondering about him, it put me in a part of my brain that's a very healing part of the brain where you wonder. And so you shift from judgment to curiosity and wonder. And if you just, you know, use that concept with your partner, instead of judging them for acting certain ways, wonder what it is about them that causes them to act certain ways. And the result of wondering about your partner is a very transformational experience for both your partner and you.
Well, that's a great story to share. Thank you. You know, how do you get to the place where you're not reactive so you can be curious about your partner and, you know, just ask questions and try to understand who they are? How do you get to that place when you are reactive with each other?
I think, and Helen, let's see. I think that let me start another point. I think that when you're in the reactive state, and you're already aroused, or you have shut down, which are the two ways you deal with affect and emotion, that when you're there in it, that it's very hard to do anything, and we would just recommend that people take a time out and move out of the tension for 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 2 hours, whatever they need to break the impasse, and then come back. And what we encourage people to do is to learn how to repair the rupture. And one of the things you have to practice certain skills, and the one that we teach couples is called Imago Dialogue, which is a three-step process. And so when you break down and take a time out, if you know the dialogue process, you can come back and have a conversation that's structured, in which you one person talks and the other one mirrors. And the rule is rigid. When you're mirroring, you can't talk. You can't do inputs. You have to receive and mirror, receive and mirror, receive and mirror. And what happens there is that process regulates the relationship between your emotions and your thinking, and you can't stay in your emotions when you are reflecting on what your partner is saying. So it puts you into your prefrontal cortex. There are no feelings there, so you move out of your own reactivity and you can hold the partner who is sending something. So that's a process people just simply have to learn. It's like playing tennis. If you want to play tennis, here's the way tennis works. And if you want to have a great conversation that's safe and you can connect, here's how that kind of conversation works. So you have to learn it. For people who haven't had and don't have access to learning that, we encourage them to do three things if you get into a bind. And one is to take the time out, because you can't do much as long as you've got a lock on each other's jaw or neck. Take a time out and then come back and say, and here's very simple, let's try that transaction again. It's called a redo. Let's redo that. And if you don't quite know what your partner needs, or you or your partner don't know what you need, then we say, now let me model it for you. Could you say it this way or do this? And so you can redo and model and redo. And then that means you're responding to each other's needs and you're resending the message that was provocative and resending it without it provoking. So those are the two interactive things that are verbal. And then there are nonverbal things like you come back from the timeout, give each other a hug. Sometimes that, because when you hug each other and hug for a minute, that will generate oxytocin in your biochemistry, and oxytocin is a bonding chemical. It also generates another flow of endorphin, and so that you'll begin to feel good and connected. So a hug is often good. Apologies work for some couples. So you just come back and say, I really apologize for my behavior. And so sometimes that, or sometimes you need a gift. So you bring flowers or do that. But couples have to talk to each other enough to know what would mitigate the impasse. Is it a hug? Is it flowers? Is it an apology? Do we have to actually do a dialogue? And whatever the answer is, it's important to repair as quickly as possible so that your brain doesn't become adapted to the separated state and habituate that rather than the connected state. You never want to stay separate and separated very long, because your brain, in the service of regulating pain, will then habituate that state and say, well, stay here, not getting hurt here, stay in the cave or up the tree or wherever you are, don't move and don't change and don't move toward. That will simply then become a fixed and frozen memory that will make it much harder to move back together later. So quickly repair using what we would call the reconnecting skills.
So the first step in that is to get an agreement with your partner that both of you are willing to try some strategies when things get rough.
Yes.
So, I mean, that has to be agreed upon before any event happens, because otherwise, if you don't have that agreement and have some of those skills, you'll just go back into those old behaviors, which generate all that pain, separation.
Yes, you will. Yes, you will.
So go ahead, Helen.
That's the ideal thing, but sometimes your partner won't make that commitment, in which mm-hmm. case someone can just do it on their own and let their partner experience it. And mm-hmm. they might need a little support system, but do it on their own. And the one thing you don't do is tell your partner what to do. But you could invite your partner to take you to a workshop of mm-hmm. any relationship workshop. Ours are great, and we have other therapists to do a MAGA workshop, but any workshop. And in doing so, you might want to say to your partner, hey, honey, it's Valentine's Day coming up. It's a Valentine's gift. No chocolates, no champagne. What I'd really love is sometime in the next 6 months for us to go to a workshop. And or you can say, I want chocolate, champagne, and I'd like to go to a workshop. But I think if you do ask someone to go to the workshop, you might say, I really am interested in what I could learn so that you could be happier in our relationship. I'd really like to understand what I might be able to do better. And then maybe your partner would go, and then maybe they would both make the commitment to do the process.
So I wonder, can couples learn to do these strategies without going to a workshop? I mean, obviously, you have a book. What other resources do you make available for couples to learn this?
Well, it's a really good question, and I think the answer is yes. A workshop is more efficient because you get the material accurately, you get to practice, you get your practice supervised, and so you walk away like you would going to a tennis game. You walk away with a skill. But we have, as you mentioned at the beginning, that the Getting Love You Want, which is now coming out in its 30th anniversary edition after 4 million sales, we have received a lot of mail from people, couples, who have read the part three, which is called Exercises, in which there are a range of practices. And we've had people meet us, you know, in odd places or ordinary places and say, thank you for saving our marriage. And we've seen so many people, we don't know whether they were in our presence or not some years ago or not. And we say, tell me how that happened. And many of them say, well, we read the book. Oh, you healed your marriage by reading a book. Yes, we did the exercises, and they all worked. So that's what you can do. This radio that you're now doing is a beginning way for people to begin getting information. I think the thing that we would have to say, any relational information is better than none. So wherever you hear somebody say something like, learn how to talk, do better communication, take a time out if you're stuck, or any kind of information. We have a very systematic, systemic system in which one thing is connected to the other. And we think it's very efficient when you go through the system. But any information is better than no information. So use what anybody says. What everybody will say is that yelling and screaming or hitting and hurting, calling people names and all of that is destructive. So stay with the I think and feel rather than you. Anytime you say you, especially when you're mad, your partner's brain puts up a defense. It closes like a fort. This closes off. So you always should say I. There's good information that your radio show will bring out. So that we would say, get data, train yourself, practice something that works. And eventually, if you're committed to that, you'll find that if you change one thing in your relationship, everything else will begin to shift because you are a system, and systems are that way. It's if you change one thing, like your tone of voice, or make an appointment before you want to talk, or give each other three appreciations a day and do that. But you have to do it over and over and over again until it becomes a fixed pattern and begins to rearrange the neurons in your brain. Then you'll change. So you don't have to do a whole lot at once. Just do one thing a lot, one thing constructive a lot, and it begins to change the whole system.
Oh, that's great advice. I wanted to ask you, at what point do you recommend couples actually separate? You know, when is that the best choice for a relationship?
The only time I ever would support a separation is if one of them or both of them were in lethal danger of hurting or killing each other. Aside from that, we know that if there was ever a romantic experience, that you can recover that, but you can recover it only if you learn how to create safety in your relationship. If you create safety and sustain safety, something wonderful happens in your brain and your neurochemistry that will begin to be bonding. Because safety is a commodity that human beings crave and try to make happen all the time, but fail every transaction. People who want to feel safe become dangerous because they complain and criticize and so forth. But if you will learn how to be safe, i.e. by being affirmative and positive and approaching people with kindness and becoming safe in your conversation, the brain will change, the neurochemistry will change, the chemicals in your blood, you'll get oxytocin and endorphins and sometimes dopamine, and you can find your way back from the, and Helen and I say that because we had a bad relationship for 20 years, got to almost to the divorce court, and decided that we were going to give ourselves a 9-month practice period. And we deliberately practiced every day, zero negativity and giving each other affirmations and using the dialogue process. And about 9 months into that, we decided we would have a second marriage. We didn't divorce, but we were emotionally divorced. Decided to have each other's second marriage, and so that was about 20 years ago. And since then, we moved into a relationship that neither one of us imagined as a possibility, but now we know it's a reality.
Well, so you're living examples of your work.
Well, the hard way. It took a while, but it took making a commitment to the process. You know, you just can't want something. You have to do something. But you also have to do the thing that works, not just anything, but anything that's connectional actually works.
Yeah, I think I would say, this is just my theory, that because you too had gone through that period of difficulty and then made the commitment and put into practice the strategies, that you're so much more powerful in your work and in your presence together, just because you embody this energy, this frequency of unconditional love and the journey you've been on.
Well, yeah. People tell us that the fact that we are have decided that we're not going to hide our own struggle from them gives them hope. And so that's it's not any fun rolling out. We almost divorced, but when somebody comes up and says, "Oh my God, and you almost divorced, and you're doing this, you're here like this," it's like, well, that's worth it if it motivates somebody, because divorce is a big tragedy. So many things are ruptured. It's so costly in all different kinds of ways, like money wise. I think something like $3 billion a year is the charge to the public treasury for the divorce rate in America. Well, that's a lot of money. And in Dallas alone, where we are, the average divorce costs $30,000. The divorce rate means that Dallas spends about $30 million a year on the divorces that occur in Dallas. So economically it's that, but then think about what happens to the children, the second home, the decrease in the income of both parents, the increasing possibilities of physical health, emotional depression and anger. It's just too costly when it can be repaired, and repaired rather rapidly if you use the right relational technology.
Well, that's
Helen,
fine.
I'm talking
so
a lot. You want to add to that?
Yes, please, Helen.
I don't really have anything to add. I think that was beautifully said.
Oh, thank you.
I just think the purpose of us all is to be in relationship with someone that touches our heart, and we grow parts of ourselves we would never grow without being in a relationship where two people are vulnerable. And I love the phrase, incompatibility is the grounds for marriage, that we're attracted to someone very different, and then when we open our eyes, we don't like what we see. But don't give up at that point, that it's incompatibility which is the grounds for marriage, and you have to transform that incompatibility into the relationship of your dreams.
Well, that is a beautiful thought to end our conversation with. And I just want to say that Getting the Love You Want is a profound book. I recommend this book to every couple I know because in it are the strategies to help them create a successful, loving, and healing relationship. So it's like the Bible for all relationships. And if people want to learn more, first of all, get a copy of Getting the Love You Want by Harville Hendricks and Helen McKelly Hunt, and visit their website, Harville and Helen, very cute name for a website, I like that, harvilleandhelen.com, to learn more and to find the way that you can start incorporating these skills, resources, understandings, so you can navigate successfully through a relationship to create the relationship of your dreams. So, Harville and Helen, thank you so much for your time today, for the wonderful work you're doing, and for the many hundreds, thousands, and millions of relationships that you have helped to save and heal. So, my gratitude to you both.
Well, and our gratitude to you for interviewing us and helping us talk about this for couples, and for being our advocate, and we are yours, and we wish you well.
Thank you so much.
Yes. So, honored to be with you.
Thank you, Helen. So thank you, Harville Hendricks, Helen McKelly Hunt, authors of Getting the Love You Want. Thank you for being with me today, everyone. And remember, I'm back again every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And until then, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.